Imprisoned at the Ritz, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Saudi crown prince has members of his own royal family arrested.
They're all being detained in four-star hotels, including the Ritz-Carlton. So it's Saudi Arabia's version of Club Fed.
So what's going on with the House of Saud? Also, a new batch of leaked documents shows how the 1% avoid paying taxes.
The money that is going into tax havens is actually money that is being missed by states like the U.S. That is money that could be otherwise spent for hospitals, for schools, for universities.
Plus, Trump tells the Japanese to build more cars in America. But wait.
Japanese car makers make about 4 million vehicles a year in the United States. They've been building vehicles here since 1982.
Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World on a Monday. A mass shooting in Texas, a crackdown, a political shakeup, and a mystery in Saudi Arabia. And paradise, not looking so calm and serene today. We're going to get to all of that and more in the coming hour, not to mention some car talk of our own. We'll discuss a fact that President Trump didn't seem to know, that there are already lots of Japanese cars made right here in the U.S. But first, paradise, found, as in the Paradise Papers, a trove of documents leaked to the German newspaper Süddeutsche Zeitung. The same two journalists there who received the Panama Papers leak in 2015 now have a sequel, and it's also about how the rich and powerful hide their money from tax collectors.
In German, the word for tax havens is, you would roughly translate, tax paradise.
That's Süddeutsche Zeitung correspondent Frederick Obermeier. He's one of the two journalists who received the leaked docs. When he came by our studios today, I asked him about the law firm Appleby, which has offices in the major offshore tax havens, and what its role is in the Paradise Papers revelations.
Appleby claimed in the past that they were the good ones in the offshore financial industry. So in comparison, for example, to Mossack Fonseca, that was the company in the center of the Panama Papers.
Right.
But what we did see now in the leaked data, that they were not as clean as they always claimed, that they did have many dubious and shady guys among their clients.
Do you have one example of one of those clients?
They had the brothers Rotenberg, Boris and Arkady Rotenberg, among their clients. And those guys are very close to Vladimir Putin. They are sanctioned by the U.S., respectively by the European Union. And we did see that even after they have been sanctioned, they still were for a certain period of time among the customers of Appleby.
You're not going to reveal who the source is or what the sources are, but how do you cultivate the trust so that you are on the receiving end of like 13.4 million documents?
I hope you do understand that I don't want to go into detail in regards to the sources of Süddeutsche Zeitung, but I think that our newspaper has proved in the past that we are able to keep our sources secret if they want, and that we are able to keep such an investigation secret, because that's still a thing. We worked for so many a month on it, and it would be a disaster for us to basically, if it would have blown before we were ready.
I mean, the big picture of this leak is that massive amounts of money, mostly American, UK, and Hong Kong sources, is parked in about 25,000 companies headquartered for tax reasons in four places, primarily the Cayman Islands, British Virgin Islands, Bermuda, and the Isle of Man in the UK. So we're talking people from U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to Bono to Queen Elizabeth. If we take this one big U.S. connection with Wilbur Ross, what do these documents tell us about the U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross?
The Paradise Papers show that Wilbur Ross had ties to Russia, that he profited from business activities with a company that is close to Vladimir Putin's inner circle, and that the Senate obviously seems to not have been aware of that fact.
I'm wondering, did he do anything illegal?
As far as we do see it now, it was not illegal what he did, but I do see a clear conflict of interest. Because if you, as the Secretary of Commerce, are profiting from business activities with a company that is in parts owned by Vladimir Putin's son-in-law, that raises the question how independent he is in all his decision concerning U.S. politics. He should have raised and made it really clearly before becoming secretary. And I think now some senators are demanding investigations now.
So why do you think Wilbur Ross would not disclose these business dealings when he was up for confirmation?
Well, yesterday there was this announcement that he would not have known who are the shareholders of this Russian company called Sibur. And I must admit, I'm a little bit skeptical on that one, because you can find the shareholders on Cibor's homepage, and it's not really hidden. You can find that Kirill Shamalov, the son-in-law of Vladimir Putin, is one of the shareholders. So it is public information. And I think as Secretary of Commerce, you should be really sure if you keep these investments while being already a secretary. I think you should be really sure with whom you're doing business, because otherwise that raises suspicion.
And what do these documents tell us about Queen Elizabeth?
The documents show that one investment fund where the estate of the Queen is in, that this fund was invested in the Cayman Islands. It's a complicated structure, but in the end, there was an investment to a company that was in the center of some critics in the past, because it was a company that basically sold household goods to people that do not have that much money, but sold it to them via a loan.
Right, kind of a rent-a-center.
Yeah, and as soon as we approached the Queen's officials responsible for that one, they claimed, well, we did not know that the fund invested in that one, but there we are again. At the question, if you do invest somewhere, shouldn't you know where the money goes to?
So last year it was the Panama Papers, another massive leak, actually bigger than this leak. That was 2.6 terabytes. I feel like a lot of people have forgotten about the Panama Papers. Maybe it's just like some of these connections are so complex that people shy away from digging deeper. What good are these revelations if people don't stay with the narrative?
These kind of investigations help to tell the public what is going on in the offshore world and what implications it does have. Because I do see a big problem if one part of the population, normally the rich part, has the possibility to avoid or evade taxes and the other part does not have. And of course, this is very complicated stuff, but we should all be aware that the money that is going into tax havens is actually money that is normally not being taxed. And that is money that is being missed by states like the US, Germany, or UK. That is money that could be otherwise spent for hospitals, for schools, for universities. So I think these kind of leaks keep up the debate about what society wants to accept. And on the other hand side, it is a signal. It is a signal to people doing business in secrecy jurisdictions. And the signal is, you cannot feel safe anymore. There were so many leaks already in the past. And we thought that the Panama Papers would be maybe the last. And now, I mean,
yeah, people said it was going to blow the lid off of this whole offshore tax thing.
And now, 1.5 years later, here we are again with another leak and new revelations. So I think nobody doing business in offshore jurisdictions can feel safe anymore.
Frederick Obermeier, one of the two journalists at Süddeutsche Zeitung who were on the receiving end of the Paradise Papers leak. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
For more detail on what's in those 13 million plus leaked documents, just go to PRI.org. Now let's hear how the Paradise Papers have added fuel to another story we've been following closely. Remember those hearings we told you about last week in Washington where Facebook and Twitter got grilled about content that was paid for by Russian trolls during last year's presidential election? Well, the Paradise Papers now reveal this. Tech giants like Facebook and Twitter actually got millions of dollars in investments from Russian institutions with close ties to the Kremlin. Question is, are the two related? The World's Charles Maines has been following the story from Moscow, so we've learned that these investments were made through Russian venture capitalist Yuri Milner. Tell us about him, Charles. Who is he?
You know, you might think of Milner as the Elon Musk of Russia. He's got a background in physics. He's had stints, a very impressive resume with stints at the World Bank. And he's become a very influential investor, as you know, not just in Facebook and in Twitter, but also many other companies that we know, such as Airbnb, Spotify, or if you look to the Chinese market, Alibaba.
So establish the connection for us between Yuri Milner and Facebook and Twitter.
Well, so this comes down to the fact that Yuri Milner's company, DST Global, invested money in both Twitter and Facebook, but they used funds coming from VTB Bank, that's a Russian state-owned bank, as well as the investment arm of Gazprom. That's the great giant oil and gas holding that's also owned by the Russian state government. And VTB basically put about just shy of $200 million in Twitter back in 2011. And around the same time, Gazprom invested about the same amount into Facebook. Both are now under sanctions by the U.S. For Russia's actions in Ukraine. But they weren't at the time of the sales.
So a Russian state bank and Gazprom, we're talking two state interests. Does that mean the money was coming from the Kremlin for these investments in Facebook and Twitter?
Well, that's the big issue debated here, because Mr. Milner will say that he was unaware that, for example, VTB was the primary funding stream for investments in Twitter, or that Gazprom Investing was actually using state money.
So is there anything illegal about this, what Yuri Milner has done? And were Facebook and Twitter aware that this money was coming from Russian state institutions?
Well, Facebook and Twitter say they were not made aware of the funding for the investments, that they were coming from this VTB bank or this arm of Gazprom. At that time, neither was under U.S. sanctions. Russia had yet to invade Ukraine. It was a different time. And so I think at this point, there's nothing you can say that really shows that this had anything to do with any sort of illegal activity. In fact, you look at Mr. Milner, and he sold his shares in Facebook. They made a fortune, as well as their shares in Twitter. And this was all before the current election scandal that we see now.
One detail, Yuri Milner, he holds a stake in a company that is co-owned by Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law and senior White House advisor. Is that correct?
That's right. He also has among his portfolio investments in a real estate venture that was founded and partly owned by Jared Kushner, as you note. Now, these two they've met once, or Mr. Milner says he's met Jared Kushner just once. It's sort of a social event, and they're not really in associates in any way. But it's just part of his wider portfolio. And again, you know, I think if you look at the backdrop of a lot of these, interest in possible conflicts of interest within the Trump administration, certainly this might also make the list. Jared Kushner didn't list this investment initially, but then revised his reports when he resubmitted information upon taking his role as a White House advisor.
I mean, Charles, you and I have talked about how Russia views the U.S. right now. They kind of see us with a bit of hysteria painted all over this country. But these revelations came out of a German newspaper, these leaks. So what are they saying now?
Well, I mean, the problem is that if you go back to this, you know, so what I think is probably of most interest to Americans here is, okay, where there's these investments by Russian state entities in Facebook, in Twitter, was this some part of some master strategy? It seems to be from a different period, and certainly Mr. Milner sold his shares before this election scandal kicked off. Now, if you look at Russian reaction to these hearings by Facebook's not executives, but lawyers on Capitol Hill and Twitter as well, you know, they say, look, I mean, this stuff is, you know, even if you look at some of the money that was invested in these troll factories, or you look at some of the kind of shoddy campaigns that were pushed through social media, that this against the backdrop of, you know, $1 billion by each party trying to convince someone to push, leave or fire either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton just pales in comparison. So even among people who are no fans of the Russian government, it's a hard sell.
The World's Charles Maynes in Moscow. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
A quick look ahead before we take a break. Later in the show, we'll have two stories that relate to how fake news is generated. One's about how, in the hours after a gunman attacked that church in Texas, internet trolls went to work making up stuff about the shooter.
He started by suggesting that perhaps he was a Democrat, and then from there said maybe he is a communist sympathizer who wants to start a revolution, and then decided that actually he was a member of Antifa.
Plus, we'll hear about some analysis done by a Twitter employee back in 2015.
He found that a significant proportion of total accounts ever created on Twitter had Russian or Ukrainian IP addresses. And when they did a further analysis into this, they found that many of them were either inactive or fake accounts.
Two real news stories about fake news. That's coming up later, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. President Trump likes to complain about trade and how, in his view, other countries tend to take advantage of their trade deals with the U.S. He's apparently taken that attitude on the road on his current trip to Asia. Here's what he told business leaders in Tokyo yesterday.
We love it when you build cars. If you're a Japanese firm, we love it. Try building your cars in the United States instead of shipping them over. Is that possible to ask? That's not rude. Is that rude? I don't think so.
I don't know if it's rude, but it's definitely misinformed. Kristen Jicek is at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So tell us where Japanese cars are built, like how many Japanese cars are built here in the U.S.
Japanese car makers make about 4 million vehicles a year in the United States. They've been building vehicles here since 1982, and it makes up about a third of all vehicles produced in the United States.
So since 1982, that kind of volume.
The volume has grown certainly over the years, but the first plant was here in 1982.
And why did Japanese car companies move manufacturing to the U.S.?
Well, you know, there were a lot of things going on back then. There were voluntary trade restraint agreements in trade with vehicles with Japan. They moved here as a currency hedge. They moved here to be closer to the market in which they are selling.
Yeah, I was just kind of looking at an inventory of the plants. I mean, Honda's got 4. It seems Toyota has 5 plants here. And I see that Mazda and Toyota are announcing that they're going to invest $1.6 billion to start a new plant in the U.S. So 4 million automobiles per year produced by the Japanese here in the States, that's grown over time, as you said. Is this new investment continuing that trend?
Absolutely. They've also invested in Canada and Mexico, which, as long as we have NAFTA, are part of a unified market here in this region of the world. And their production in Canada and Mexico contain engines and transmissions and parts that are built in the United States, more so than those vehicles would if they were imported from Japan.
So Trump has also complained about the fact that while Japan's automakers sell millions of cars in the U.S. every year, Detroit's big three are essentially shut out of Japan. Is that true?
It's long been a problem to get Japanese consumers to buy U.S.-built vehicles. Japan sent us 1.6 million vehicles last year, and then the U.S. sent about 15,000 vehicles to Japan. And those vehicles tend to be, I've got that list of them in front of me right now, some Jeeps, Ford Mustangs, some iconic vehicles like Camaro and Corvette, a few pickup trucks, and some Teslas.
Kristen, do you have a sense of what the benefits are to the communities where the big three Japanese automakers have set up shop? Like Toyota alone has plants in Indiana and Kentucky. My sense is that these companies take their roles in these communities pretty seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. We've done a number of studies for automakers, including the Japanese automakers, about the impact of their jobs here in the U.S. They look very seriously at their employment footprint here, their supplier buy here, their philanthropy that they do in the country. They're wanting to be a part of the fabric of our economy when they move here.
Kristen Jicek at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
After Japan, President Trump's next stop is South Korea. High on his agenda there, of course, the escalating tensions with North Korea. On the surface, those tensions don't seem to be causing much alarm in the South. That's what we've been hearing. But that apparent calm could be deceiving. Jason Strother has more from Pyeongtaek, just south of Seoul.
Woo Soon Yep keeps a camouflage backpack loaded with supplies, just in case he needs to grab it and go. It's got things like a flashlight, canned food, and a pair of socks. Woo runs an online forum with 20,000 members called Survival 21. He says he's trying to help people prepare for war, but most South Koreans don't take North Korea's threats seriously. Even members of his online community, they don't want to say the word war.
There's a superstition that if you say bad things, those bad things could actually happen. They'd rather just ignore the possibility of war altogether. I think they're in a state of denial.
Some mental health professionals say Woo might be onto something. Kim Hyun-chung is a psychiatrist at the National Medical Center in Seoul. She says a lot of South Koreans have suppressed their fears of another Korean War because deep down, they feel helpless.
If we're so sensitive to all the dangers that lurk here, I mean, you can't live here.
Kim says some people, like her, cope with this buried anxiety with dark humor.
Saying, oh, I'll evaporate anyways. What the hell with it, you know? I hope it all blows up so I don't have to go to work tomorrow.
Others try to change the subject and say comforting things like,
you know, a war isn't that easy to happen. People aren't going to let it happen. Don't worry about it. So we end the conversation in a very comforting manner so that we don't have to go to extent about fretting over something that's real. Which sounds ironical, but yeah, that's what we're doing.
It sounds like there's a combination
avoidance.
Of feelings.
I'm avoiding the topic. I don't want to talk about it, you know? And because I thought I was open to it. I don't want to imagine it. Just by imagining it, I kept imagining as our interview has gone on, and I started freaking out. And I didn't know I was this... I thought I was ready, you know, I'd blow it up, whatever. But I don't think it's... I don't want to think about it.
She says maybe it's time now for her to start talking with her husband and their 10-year-old son about what to do in the case of an attack. Kim says while she and other South Koreans have grown numb to Pyongyang's pledges to turn Seoul into a sea of fire, they're not used to hearing the same kind of rhetoric coming from Washington.
Mr. Trump has crossed a certain line.
Koo Se-young is publisher of the online magazine Korea Exposé.
And that's what's frightening to many South Koreans, I believe. And that's what certainly generated concern as well as conversation here.
Koo says it feels unreal to be having conversations now about evacuation plans with his parents who survived the Korean War. They've told him they're not going anywhere.
They will tell me, if old people go out into the street during war, they're more likely to die. So we're just going to stay in the apartment and face our last minute. And of course, we laugh about it while we say it.
He also says it's deeply troubling to hear that many Americans would support a military response to North Korea if diplomacy fails, 58%, according to a September Gallup poll. Koo wonders whether Americans really understand what war would mean here.
For us, it's a life or death matter. But perhaps for Americans, I guess it's difficult to have the same kind of idea or worries.
In August, air raid drills were held in Seoul. Residents were told to practice evacuating into some of the city's 4,100 underground shelters, including subway stations and parking garages. Woo Soon-yep, the guy with the backpack, says the government doesn't have a solid emergency response plan. That's why South Koreans need to take survival into their own hands, though he thinks there's still some time.
I tell people that while war might be looming, it's not going to happen right away. I think a war could break out within a year or so, but still, I don't think it's imminent.
But just in case, Woo recently added a gas mask to his backpack. For The World, Jason Strother, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
News headlines are coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Moving from Syria to the United States has many challenges. This mother is just discovering a few of them.
For me, as a Syrian parent, having an American teenager is way too tough. She argues with me all the time.
Cross-cultural adventures coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In Saudi Arabia, it was a kind of weekend that conspiracy theories get built around. Several Saudi princes rounded up and locked away in four-star hotels, another prince and his staff killed in a helicopter crash, and an announcement in the Saudi capital by the Prime Minister of Lebanon that he was stepping down. More about Lebanon in a minute. First, though, let's focus on the apparent royal purge in Saudi Arabia, America's closest ally in the Middle East. And for that, we turn to Krishna Dev Kalamur of The Atlantic.
Details are still emerging, but the big takeaway so far has been the arrest of at least 11 people, including politicians and princes. And they're all being detained, as you said, in four-star hotels, including the Ritz-Carlton. So it's Saudi Arabia's version of Club Fed. But we aren't quite sure why this has happened yet. The public reason that they broadcast on Al Arabiya is a corruption investigation, and one of the Saudi ministers went on air to say that as Saudi citizens, they will be given due process, although we don't know what that means. And they also haven't released a list of folks who have been arrested, although media leaks say that they include Prince Al-Walid bin Talal, who's the billionaire investor who has millions invested in large U.S. companies, including Twitter, Apple, and Lyft.
When you think about Prince Al-Walid, I don't know if you have any sense of who some of the other arrests were, but this idea that it's about corruption, is it more to it than that, do you think?
You know, corruption is the reason they're giving, but it could also be, and this is something that many people are saying, is that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, is trying to consolidate his position. He became Crown Prince earlier this year, and since he has taken that position, he has taken greater reins of power so that he is undisputedly next in line to be king.
Right. And if when he becomes king, he will be king probably for a good long time.
Indeed, he's 32 years old. He is in many ways reflective of much of Saudi Arabia. I think almost half their population is under 25. And it's young people who support him en masse. The thing, though, is that Saudi Arabia is a very traditional society. And whether the folks who have been pulling the levers of power for all these years are content to let this happen so quickly, that we don't know yet.
So we're going to talk about the resignation of Prime Minister Hariri in a moment, but we hear a lot about Iran from the Saudis and from the Trump administration. How much of a threat is Iran to the region, and are fears about Iran being overblown?
I think it depends on whom you ask. From Iran's point of view, it's playing a role that's in its best interest. It is a Shia country, and it sees its position as that of being at risk from its Sunni neighbors. It also sees Shia across the Middle East, in its view, being persecuted by countries like Saudi Arabia and other places. If you're Saudi Arabia, you see a country that is meddling in practically every country in the Middle East, and the United States shares that view. Wherever the U.S. has interests in the Middle East, whether that's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Syria, whether it's Iraq, the one constant player that is at odds with the United States and its interests is Iran.
So Jared Kushner last month was in Saudi Arabia. Donald Trump spoke with the king just this weekend. Are there other lines that we should be looking at connecting the U.S. to any of what's going on right now in Saudi?
Well, the one thing I'd say is the Trump administration seems quite content to let Saudi Arabia play out its problems on its own. You've had a conflict in Yemen where Saudi Arabia has engaged in a proxy war with Iran, and it seems fairly intractable. You also have the standoff with Qatar, which doesn't seem to end despite diplomatic efforts, including by Rex Tillerson. And you have the current crackdown on the princess in Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration hasn't really commented on any of these things in a public way. I mean, the cabinet level officials have, but the White House itself has not taken a hard line in any way. The president spoke to the king of Saudi Arabia yesterday, and the White House readout of the call actually did not mention the events of the weekend. What it did say was that President Trump had hoped that the Saudis would list Saudi Aramco there, a state-run oil company, on the New York Stock Exchange, which he believed would be very good for New York. And the other thing he said was he thanked Saudi Arabia for buying the THAAD missile interceptors at a cost of, I believe, $10 or $15 billion. So Saudi Arabia is a big arms buyer from the U.S. And I think as long as those relationships are maintained, and in the president's view, they bring jobs to the U.S., he's quite happy to let them do what they want, because one of his principles has been that other countries are sovereign and they get to do what they want to do, and this may fit into that worldview.
Krishnadev Kalamur there, a senior editor at The Atlantic. Now let's connect the dots between all that Saudi intrigue and the announcement by Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri that he's stepping down. An announcement that, as I mentioned earlier, was made in Saudi Arabia. Rich Hall is the world's correspondent in Beirut. So what is the connection between the resignation of Saad Hariri and the arrest in Saudi Arabia?
So the connection appears to be that it's all the brainchild of the new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. I say new. He's been in the job for 2 years now. He's been promising to build a new Saudi Arabia, a more confident, moderate country. And Saad Hariri's resignation is seen by many as being pushed by Saudi Arabia. They support him financially and politically, and they basically call the shots when it comes to Saad Hariri in many ways.
I mean, why would Saudi Arabia want Hariri to resign? Like, what pressure would they have brought?
So the overarching message here is that Saudi Arabia is trying to rebalance the region a bit and counter Iranian influence in the region, which has grown significantly throughout the Syrian civil war. Saudi went head-to-head with Iran in Syria, backing rebel groups to try and oust Bashar al-Assad. You remember Iran went to back Assad, and Iran won that proxy conflict in so many ways. And now Saudi is looking at the region. It's seeing Iranian influence has grown dramatically, and it's looking at Lebanon as a place where it can perhaps weaken Iran's grip. Lebanon has been traditionally a place where these two have kind of fought it out. It kind of took a back seat while Syria was going on. Now Syria is winding down. Lebanon is turning into that battleground again where these two are really going to fight it out.
I still am confused why Saad Hariri would just, under any kind of pressure from anybody, would just step down.
Well, there's a sense that Saudi didn't feel like it was getting its money's worth from Hariri. Now, how it works in Lebanon here is that political parties depend on wealthy patrons, and Saudi Arabia was Hariri's. They backed him hugely with billions of dollars. And so the way that the Saudis saw it was that Hariri was basically acting as a fig leaf for Hezbollah's domination of Lebanon. So how the political system in Lebanon is set up is that the prime minister needs to be a Sunni, the parliamentary speaker needs to be a Shia, and the president needs to be a Christian. Now, as long as those people are all in place, things tick along nicely. But what happened was Saad Hariri was seen as kind of a weak Sunni leader. He was doing Hezbollah's bidding because Hezbollah had control of Lebanon's government.
So is this going to destabilize Lebanon, and who is leading the country now?
It definitely has the potential to be destabilizing, yeah. So like I say, when one group feels like they're not being represented, as the Sunnis in Lebanon may do now, people get angry. And there's also a very real danger now. Some people are speculating that Saudi is trying to build a coalition to really go after Hezbollah, perhaps even militarily. So by separating Saad Hariri and Sunnis from the government, it makes it a lot easier to characterize Lebanon and the Lebanese state as being one and the same as Hezbollah. And that really increases the risk of an Israeli attack to take out Hezbollah in Lebanon, if there's no kind of moderate opposition there to that move.
Yeah, so how's this news being received in Beirut? Like, what's the mood in the streets?
It's interesting, actually. It's a mix. I think it depends entirely on how much news you watch. So some people are kind of shrugging their shoulders and saying, "This is par and the course for being Lebanese. This always happens. We always talk about this." And I actually spoke to my neighbor just down the street, and she was the complete opposite. She was saying, "God, has this been dominating conversations between me and my friends?" She was even talking about buying extra gas and bottles of water because she feared some sort of Israeli attack. So yeah, it's a mixture. But this kind of constant instability hanging over the heads of Lebanese people was really familiar to them. They kind of had a break from it when the Syrian war was going on. Things calmed down a bit, but now it looks as though it's returned.
How do ordinary Lebanese feel about this idea that their prime minister may be controlled from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia?
That entirely depends on who you ask. Hariri's supporters will say that's nonsense. He is his own man. He's done well for us. And his critics will say the opposite. Politics in Lebanon is a very sectarian affair. People who support a certain politician will support them blindly often, and those who are opposed to them will do the same.
Rich Hall, the world's correspondent in Beirut, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Millions of Syrians have been forced to leave their homes over the past 6 years of civil war in their country. More than 5 million have abandoned Syria altogether, looking for new beginnings in other nations. When we hear about huge numbers of people like that, it can seem really impersonal. So here at The World, we like to bring a story like that down to a very personal level, to one person's or maybe one family's experience. Here's one of those stories. It's about one Syrian mom living in Massachusetts now, and her worry that among the many things her daughter has had to leave behind is her Arabic language. Not the dialect they still speak at home, but the more formal written and spoken Arabic that's used in schools, in books, public life, and all Arabic language media. So this mom came up with her own way to teach her kid. Here's Judith Kogan with that story.
Dima Basha lives outside Boston with her daughter Angelina. They came on a visit from Aleppo in 2012. Then the war broke out in their city and they couldn't go home. They still speak to each other in their home dialect, and English too. But Dima was worried her daughter was missing something important. Lessons in modern standard Arabic, Fusha. Something every Syrian student gets at school. So she put Angelina in Sunday Fusha classes at their suburban Boston mosque. But Angelina hated it and begged to quit.
Because a lot of the people there didn't really know anything of Arabic at all.
Then Dima got an idea.
I remember when she was 7 years old, she was watching SpongeBob in Arabic. And of course it was in Fusha. And I didn't notice until she was laughing loudly and saying that, "Mom, can you believe it that sirwal means pantalon?" And she was like laughing that it's a totally different word. And I thought, if she keeps watching cartoons in Fusha, then she will learn a lot of the language.
It's not just different vocabulary. Fusa and their dialect have different pronunciation and grammar rules.
So when we watch cartoons, most likely after like 5 minutes, I would ask her, did you get what they are talking about?
If I didn't understand a word, I would tell her to pause it and ask her what the word is.
Every few days, Dima and Angelina pull an Arabic cartoon off YouTube. One of their favorites is Sarah Crewe, a Japanese anime version of the Victorian story A Little Princess, dubbed in Fusa.
أنا بخير, Emilia. Ermengard. يجب أن يكون هناك سبب لفعلتك هذا.
Of course, to be fully literate, you need also to read and write the language. During summer vacation, Angela would read and record Fusa passages in her iPhone and send them to her mom at work. For Dima, learning Fusa isn't just a practical matter, it's their culture.
I think it's a very beautiful language, very rich. I want her to understand the news, the poetry, the stories. It's amazing when you dance to an Arabic song and you understand the meaning of it. You dance differently.
Angelina understands all this.
The Syrian culture is still like a big part of our lives. Syrian food is the best food there ever was.
And she thinks she may find herself back in Syria one day.
If I go back to school in Syria, I probably need to be talking, writing, and reading in Fusha. Or if I got a job there when I'm older, I would need to be able to read and write Fusha and probably talk Fusha.
Angelina knew some Fusha when she arrived in the U.S., but she hasn't kept pace with her friends back home.
She studied until second grade in Syria, and I would say that her Arabic now is a fourth grader, but not more than that. She hasn't been acquiring new words, new ways of putting the word also. And this is what I'm worried about.
It's not surprising that Angelina's formal Arabic is stuck at a fourth grade level. She came here when she was 7. Now she's 13, which presents a whole new set of challenges for her mom.
For me, as a Syrian parent, having an American teenager is way too tough. She argues with me all the time, and whenever I say, you argue about everything, she would say, well, I want to become a lawyer, and this is what lawyers do all the time. They argue. Which is a good point, but it doesn't have to be with me. She can do that with the judge.
But she says it's not that hard to get Angelina to watch cartoons in Arabic.
So whenever she doesn't do it, I will tell her, we're going back to Sunday school.
For The World, Judith Kogan, Newton, Massachusetts.
For weeks now, Twitter, Facebook, and Google have been busy acknowledging how their platforms are used by Russian agents during the last U.S. presidential election campaign. Twitter, for one, has identified more than 36,000 accounts linked to Russian interference, but the company is also under scrutiny for what it hasn't done, like its failure to take action when it got warnings about bots and spam accounts originating in Russia and Ukraine, warnings from people like Leslie Miley. He was Twitter's engineering manager of product safety and security from 2013 to 15. Selena Wang is a reporter for Bloomberg Business who's been covering the story. Tell us what Leslie Miley noticed in 2015 while working for Twitter.
So a group of researchers from UC Berkeley approached him and his team saying, we found some research showing that Twitter has a pretty significant number of fake accounts and much larger than what they normally report. So they didn't end up giving these researchers extra data, but that meeting made them very curious. And they ran just a pretty simple analysis. And Leslie told me that he found that a significant proportion of total accounts ever created on Twitter had Russian or Ukrainian IP addresses. And when they did a further analysis into this, they found that many of them were either inactive or fake accounts. And he then brought this to his manager, who told him to bring it to the growth team. Now, the growth team makes sure that numbers are growing, that revenue is growing, and users are growing. And they declined to do anything with the accounts as far as he was aware of during his time at Twitter.
Wow. So do we know why they didn't do anything?
Well, at the time, he was told, stay in your lane. This isn't your job. Your product safety. And at the time, they defined that rather narrowly. Product safety means rooting out abuse on the platform. So I don't know if you remember a few years back, there was a celebrity nude photo leak or, right. you know, the ISIS beheading videos. That was the type of stuff that they wanted his team to focus on. And of course, Twitter, since its very inception, has dealt with this problem of safety and security versus growth. The more resources you put towards security, the less you can allocate to other parts of the platform. And the more that you dampen abusive and spam accounts, the lower that the numbers seem. Now, Twitter has come a long way just in the last couple of years. And when Jack Dorsey took over as CEO, he said that he was really going to make safety and security a priority. And their former CEO, Dick Costolo, actually came out and said, you know what, we've really sucked at this. And he admitted that Twitter had a really big problem on this. And when they were testifying in front of Congress, Twitter did say that they were dedicating all of its engineering resources to rooting out Russian manipulation on the platform. But that also is very telling. The fact that they have to pull engineers from other teams to address this issue just shows how cash-strapped and the lack of engineering sources that they actually have. And then on the flip side of that, you have Facebook that's hiring tens of thousands of additional people to deal with the problem.
Now, Twitter says that less than 5% of its accounts are spam accounts, but outside research findings put it closer to 15%. Do we believe that Twitter is doing enough to shut down and prevent bots? It's telling Congress it is, but what do the experts think?
That discrepancy is quite large, and it's something that Congress people really pressed Twitter on last week during the testimonies. And Twitter's explanation is that they're only giving researchers a small slice of their data, so they can't possibly know the whole picture. Now, researchers I speak to are incredibly frustrated with Twitter because Twitter declines to give them all the data they need, so they don't think it's really a fair argument. That's a big tension that's been bubbling between researchers and Twitter for many, many years. But when you talk to outside researchers, their general sentiment is that all of these platforms have improved their security measures in recent years. Facebook's been the best. Google's not far behind. And Twitter is usually last and always resists this type of change.
Selena Wang, a reporter with Bloomberg Business in San Francisco. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally today, we're still learning new information about yesterday's church shooting in Texas. Here are a couple of things we know for sure. The gunman killed at least 26 people, and the shooting quickly generated a lot of fake news. We wanted to know more about how misinformation spreads after an incident like this. So we turned to Tim Squirrel. He's a researcher at the University of Edinburgh studying online communities. He says there's one fake news story in particular about the gunman's alleged motivation that's been gaining steam.
The primary one that's coming around has been spread by, I believe, 4chan, in addition to Mike Cernovich and a bunch of other people on the alt-right, who started by suggesting that perhaps he was a Democrat, and then from there said maybe he is a communist sympathizer who wants to start a revolution, and then decided that actually he was a member of Antifa, which is the loose association of individuals who turn up at protests and oppose fascism, which the alt-right has managed to whip into a boogeyman which haunts all political discourse. When anyone talks about white supremacy, anyone talks about the far right or the extreme right, the idea is that there's a symmetrical, evil, shadowy cabal of people on the left called Antifa, and that he was a member of that.
And how rapidly do these discussions on places like 4chan then kind of spread to parts of the internet that some people might see as mainstream and would spread it from there?
Oh, incredibly rapidly. In this instance, for example, they made up a Facebook profile for the guy who did the shooting and made up a sort of timeline, put it out onto Twitter, and it immediately gets picked up by various media sources, at which point it's almost impossible to tamp down on. If you go into Google now, the autocomplete, if you search for Texas shooter, will say Texas shooter, Antifa, wow. Texas shooter identified.
Are these stories, these fake news stories, are they coming from inside the U.S., outside the U.S.?
It's a mix. Some of them will come from straight inside the U.S., and some of them will come from places like Russia. A huge amount of the politicization of these news stories is being, if not initiated, then at least encouraged by Russia and Russian activists. So they have both their professional troll network as well as various people who are not paid, who engage in sort of activism which attempts to propagate the idea that the US is under attack by left-wing or black identity extremists and so on and so forth.
Tim, this is a bit of an aside, but as long as I've got you with us, tell us who Sam Hyde is and why he always seems to get blamed for mass shootings.
Sam Hyde is a comedian who pops up every single time there is any kind of shooting in the US. So he's been misattributed as the lone gunman in the shootings in San Bernardino, Kalamazoo, Baton Rouge, Orlando, and now the one in Sutherland Springs.
And why? Why him?
Honestly, I'm not entirely certain. I would imagine that to begin with, it was probably a joke. And then, as with a lot of these things, it just catches on. And the problem is that because a lot of the people who get put up as talking heads are not incredibly well informed, almost every time there's going to be at least one senator, one congressman, one pundit who names Sam Hyde on CNN in this instance, or names him on some other show, which means that it becomes attributed to him and then spreads around.
Tim Squirrel is a researcher at the University of Edinburgh, where he studies online communities. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we're going to have to leave it there today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Much more tomorrow. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.